for a composer that is the subject of these two lectures. Christoph Willibald Gluck, 1714 to 1787. Gluck once said of the Italian opera seria of his day, "Oh, it's all very fine, but it doesn't draw blood." Gluck was a reformer, one of the most important reformers in all of opera history. He managed to effect a synthesis of the new Italian style and traditional French opera. And in doing so, my friends, he became one of the most influential composers, really, of all time. Gluck's operas had a profound effect on composers from Mozart to Berlioz and, indeed, even beyond. Gluck was an international man and an international composer. He was born of Bohemian parents in what is now Bavaria in southern Germany. Gluck studied in Italy with Giovanni Battista Sammartini, an important composer of both instrumental music and opera. Over the course of his career, Gluck composed operas in London, toured throughout Germany as the conductor of an opera company, became court composer to the Habsburg Emperor Charles VI at Vienna, where I would tell you one of his young voice students was the young Austrian princess, Marie Antoinette. Ultimately, Gluck triumphed in Paris under the patronage of a now older, now queen, Marie Antoinette. As Gluck's greatest fame and greatest influence were achieved in Paris, our brief discussion will focus on his reforms and influence on French opera. Gluck's artistic development. Okay, Gluck's first operas were Italian opera seria, fully within the tradition and with all the accompanying formula that designation implies. Two forces profoundly affected the way Gluck thought about, and indeed the way he wrote music. The first of these influences was the spirit of the Enlightenment, the second being a growing familiarity with French opera. First, the spirit of the Enlightenment. Look, we needn't go back through a detailed examination of the tenets and ideals of the Enlightenment. Suffice it to say for now that Gluck, like so many of his contemporaries, was swept away by the artistic desire for free, simple, non-formulaic, unaffected expression of human feelings in music, in opera. Now, in practical terms, for Gluck, this meant two things. Firstly, he had to project via music what he considered to be the true feelings felt behind the words being sung. And second of all, he had to rein in his singers, and in doing so, he aimed for a more direct and simple singing style in his arias. Gluck wrote in 1769, "I sought to confine music to its true function of serving the poetry by expressing feelings and the situations of the story without interrupting and cooling off the action through useless and superfluous ornaments. I believed that music should join poetry what the vividness of colors and well-disposed lights and shadows contribute to a correct and well-composed design, animating the figures without altering their contours. I further believed that the greater part of my task was to seek a beautiful simplicity, and I have avoided a display of vocal difficulty at the expense of literary clarity. I assigned no value to the discovery of some novelty unless it was naturally suggested by the situation and the expression, and there is no rule that I did not willingly consider sacrificing for the sake of dramatic effect." So what is Gluck telling us? He's telling us he's anti-dogma, and he's anti-formula, despite the fact that he's still writing within a fairly formulaic genre. Now, the second force, the second influence affecting the way Gluck thought and wrote opera has to do with the influence of French opera on him. In 1755, while living and working in Vienna, Gluck was charged with conducting, arranging, and composing a few new numbers for a number of French language operas, which, out of curiosity, were to be performed in Vienna. So it was, really almost by accident, that Gluck, in his 40s, was schooled in French opera. learning a syllabic style of text setting as opposed to the ornate melismas of Italian singing, a melodic restraint, a freedom of rhythm and phrase structure, and a close relationship between words and music, which were typical of French opera, but contrasted mightily with contemporary Italian opera. Gluck assimilated the French musical idiom thoroughly, to the point that the French poet and theater manager, Favart, spoke with the highest regard to Gluck's settings of his French language libretti. And I quote Favart, "Gluck's settings leave nothing to be desired in the expression, the taste, the harmony, even in the French prosody," unquote. So Gluck mastered in his 40s the French style of opera composing, which now will complement what he already knows about Italian style opera composing. The turning point opera for Gluck was Orfeo ed Euridice of 1762, libretto by Ranieri di Calzabigi. This piece was composed and premiered in Vienna, and it's composed in Italian. Despite all of this, the lessons learned from French opera are in clear evidence. 4 points regarding the Frenchification that we hear in Orfeo ed Euridice. Number one, this opera has melodically simple, emotionally direct arias, much more familiar in French opera than in Italian operas, where the arias tend to be ornate and complex at this time. Point two, this opera by Gluck features heightened recitative. We have no secco recitative at all in this opera. Everything is accompanied. We have a very high melodic content in these recitatives in Orfeo ed Euridice. We have very irregular phrase structures and rhythmic flexibility. Again, Gluck has taken aspects of French opera and transferred them to the Italian opera that is Orfeo ed Euridice. Third French aspect of this ostensibly Italian opera seria is the use of dance as integral to the action of his opera. Dance, when used in Italian operas, was always a secondary element, certainly not a primary element, but in this one, it is a primary element, integral to the action of the opera. And fourthly, Gluck relies heavily on a chorus. This is a French aspect, not an Italian aspect. All right, let's listen to a scene from Orfeo ed Euridice. This comes from Act 2, Scene 1. Now, this spectacular choral scene, we're not going to hear solo singers, takes place in the cavernous spaces of the underworld, obscured by thick smoke and lit only by flames. There are two separate orchestras, one for the ballet and chorus, and another consisting of harp and strings meant to accompany Orpheus and to portray the sound of his lyre. Note, however, and this is what we want to listen for in this brief time we have with this excerpt, the degree of integration of dance, chorus, and, of course, if we listened longer, solo singing. This goes way beyond Gluck's French models and will itself become a model for future French composers. That is the degree to which Gluck integrates dance, which of course will be heard as instrumental sequence on this selection, choral singing, and the portrayal of Orpheus and his lyre by that second orchestra whose job it is to accompany Orpheus and portray the plucked sounds of his lyre. The chorus will sing this, and by the way, this is a terrifying chorus. Remember, our poor, quivering little Orpheus has just got across the river Styx, and he walks into Hades, not the finest place to be at any particular time of year. And the chorus sings, "Who from Erebos, through the dark mists, in the footsteps of Hercules and the Pirithous, would ever set forth? He would be blocked with horror by the fierce Eumenides and frightened by the shrieks of Sybaris, unless he were a god." And Orpheus is not a god, and so Orpheus, if we had time to hear him speak, would say, "Please be gentle with me, Furies, Spectres, scornful phantoms." But we won't listen that far. Those first two choral utterances take a tremendous amount of time to get through because they are interspersed with an instrumental segment which is part of the ballet. Let's listen to this music, and let's be aware of the degree of ballet interspersed with choral writing, and briefly we will hear, near the beginning of the selection, the second orchestra, the one that represents Orpheus and his lyre. Please, Orfeo ed Eurydice, Gluck, Act 2, Scene 1. This is ferocious, even violent music, and it brilliantly mixes this explosive choral material with this rapid balletic sequence in between it and this magnificent and frightening overture-ish-like music that began the excerpt and completed the excerpt from where we listened. Now, Gluck moved to Paris in 1774, 12 years after he wrote this piece, but almost immediately he revised Orfeo ed Eurydice. He translated it into French, and he added further dance sequences. As we talked about, dance must be in French operas. They are often as much ballet as they are opera. And of course, it was a huge hit. This should come as no surprise to us. Ethan Mordden tells this wonderful anecdote about Gluck and the ballet master. Preparing the premiere of the new Paris version of Orfeo, Gluck had to suffer the outrageous vanity of Gaetan Vestris, who styled himself the, quote, god of the dance, unquote. If you are a god, Gluck told him, dance in heaven, not in my opera. But opera without ballet was unthinkable in Paris. "Write me a chaconne," said Vestris, planning his arabesques and pliés, and especially his curtain calls. "We are trying to depict life among the ancient Greeks," Gluck objected. "Do you think they knew what a chaconne is?" "Didn't they?" asked Vestris, utterly amazed. "Life without the chaconne? Oh, how I pity them," unquote. Yeah, dancers, well, they've spent a little too much time on their feet, one might say. Conclusion, and important conclusion this is. Gluck's operas become a model for the next generations of French composers, and for Mozart and other non-French composers. Gluck's operas demonstrated how it was possible to maintain the great tradition of French operatic pomp and magnificence, while at the same time adhering to the spirit and new melodic naturalness of the Enlightenment. Grand opera, but with an Enlightenment flair for expression and melodic directness and simplicity. French opera in the early 19th century. The combined influences of Gluck, the French Revolution, and the Napoleonic Empire made Paris the operatic capital of Europe during the first half of the 19th century. Typical of French operatic tradition, early 19th century French operas continued to celebrate heroic characters, heightened dramatic situations, delivered in a magnificent display of solo, choral, and orchestral grandiosity. So French opera in the early 19th century continues, my friends, to be a big shoe, a really, really big shoe. Now, by the early 1820s, a new sort of French opera came into being, one which modestly called itself grand opera, a really, really, really big shoe. Now, a big point. As royal and aristocratic patronage of French opera declined, an increasingly numerous and powerful middle class flocked to the opera theaters in their stead in search of maximum excitement and entertainment bang for their franc. Grand operas were designed to appeal to this new and growing middle class operatic audience, a relatively uncultured bunch out for thrills, not dramatic subtlety. What we might think of this is, my friends, the Venetianization of French opera. What happened in Italy, in Venice, in the 1650s and the 1660s, that is, the rising popularity of opera and the correspondent reduction of theatrical quality, starts happening in French opera much later, here in the 1820s, as more and more French opera composers and producers are creating opera for a middle class, not for a more sophisticated upper class. According to Donald Grout, grand opera, following in the fashion that had prevailed in France ever since the time of Lully, was as much an affair of spectacle as of music. Libretti were designed to exploit every possible occasion for ballets, choruses, and crowd scenes. Yes, crowd scenes. It would seem that the French operatic public loved nothing more than to have hundreds of people on stage, all singing at a different time, sometimes together, but sometimes not. Maximum impact. Lots of folks. Oh, they would have loved Super Bowl halftime shows, rather. I think that's what these crowds were after. Big, diverse, and colorful. Giacomo Meyerbeer almost single-handedly established this grand operatic genre with his operas Robert the Devil of 1831 and The Huguenots of 1836. Oh, let's talk about Giacomo Meyerbeer, 1791 to 1864. He was born Jacob Liebmann Beer in Berlin. While still in Germany, he changed his name to Meyerbeer, composed German operas that were dismal failures. So, he moved to Italy, changed his first name to Giacomo, wrote Italian operas with only slightly more success. So, he moved to France, wrote Robert the Devil in the prevailing French style, and enjoyed sensational success. Yes, he found a public ready to appreciate what his gifts could produce. Meyerbeer was so famous, and he was so taken with his success, that he spoke of himself like Oh, like many high-paid sports stars of today, he spoke of himself in the third person. There's a famous story that Meyerbeer heard a barking dog outside of his window, and he opened his window and he shrieked at the dog, "Quiet! Meyerbeer is working!" Oh, a couple of other anecdotes, because they're irresistible. Ethan Morden tells us, Meyerbeer couldn't work. A street musician was playing a barrel organ in the street, just outside the window of Meyerbeer's study. Worse yet, he was grounding out nothing but Rossini. Aiming a servant at the disturbance, Meyerbeer offered 2 francs if the nuisance would go play somewhere else. But no, wait! Oh, how droll of me, Meyerbeer probably thought. 4 francs if the nuisance would go play Meyerbeer's tunes in front of Rossini's house. A moment later, the servant came back. "I'm sorry, monsieur, the organ grinder says no." "No? To 4 francs? He says Rossini gave him 8 francs to bother you." Another Meyerbeer and Rossini story, because I cannot resist. Strolling through Paris with a friend, Rossini ran into Meyerbeer, who asked after his health. Rossini cited a string of physical calamities. Meyerbeer expressed all due sympathy and then moved on. Rossini's friend then urged Rossini to speed homeward to bed. "My dear fellow, I feel perfectly fine," Rossini said. "But it so cheers our friend Meyerbeer to think that I am at death's door that I hadn't the heart to disappoint him." Unquote. Look, there is no parallel in modern opera for such a total eclipse of a composer who had been as famous as Meyerbeer was in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. Now, the reason why his operas haven't had historical legs, the reason why we don't hear his operas anymore, is because they were intended as spectacle and entertainment first, music last. His librettist, Eugene Scribe, was so prolific that he was considered not a writer, but a libretto factory, unquote. Rossini was outraged by the operas that Meyerbeer and Scribe created. Rossini wrote, "I am only a composer. They are businessmen." Unquote. Tui, writes Ethan Morden, a businessman. So Meyerbeer was regarded by the art world. The ballet of defrocked nuns in Robert the Devil, or the skating ballet in Le Prophète, the stodgy processions and endless set pieces, the double choruses, one set against the other in predictable counterplay, seemed to many a vulgar carnival. "Effects without causes," was Wagner's judgment. Skating ballets. This should start sounding familiar if one thinks about a certain composer of musical theater today, in which effects are of much more importance than musical substance, in which staging and the novelty of such are more important, then one realizes why Meyerbeer's music has not survived. Because the music was incidental to the production. Because spectacular scenery and novelty were the point. It's what made Meyerbeer rich and famous, but it did not imbue his work with staying power. Indeed, Felix Mendelssohn analyzes the contents of Meyerbeer's operas. "Melodies for whistling, harmony for the educated, instrumentation for the Germans, contra dances for the French, something for everybody, but there's no heart in it." Might I suggest, with all due respect, that when we look at such contemporary writers as Andrew Lloyd Webber, we hear the same sorts of things, we see the same sorts of productions. Marvelous, visually stunning, spectacular and inventive, but does the music stand on its own? The answer is usually no. All of this having been said, Meyerbeer had an uncanny ability for managing large crowds of singers, choristers, and dancers on stage, in staging public and religious ceremonies and large dramatic confrontations, the likes of which were so popular among Parisian audiences at this time. A perfect example of Meyerbeer's ability to manage large numbers on stage is the closing moments of Act II of his opera, The Huguenots. Quickly, here's the story. Queen Marguerite de Valois of France has tried to reconcile the Protestants and the Catholics through a marriage between the Catholic Valentina and the Protestant Raoul. We'll pick up the scene at the point that Raoul rejects Valentina, the truce disintegrates, and Almerd breaks loose on stage. Look, you've got the libretto for this. I'm just going to read from the very beginning. Marguerite, the queen, in recitative. And now I must offer to your sight your charming fiancé, who will make your oath easy to keep. Saint-Brie reappears, leading Valentina towards Raoul. Raoul, with muffled voice, "Ah, great God, what do I see?" Marguerite, "What's wrong with you?" Raoul, barely able to speak, "What? It is she whom they offer to me today." Now, apparently there's been a little past history between Valentina and Raoul. Marguerite does not know that. She says, "Marriage and love together." And Raoul shouts, "Treason, treachery, I, her spouse, never, never." And everyone says, "Heavens, oh rapture, oh madness, whence comes this outrage to break these knots? What delirium inspires him?" And Raoul responds, "At this point I am outraged. I reject forever this shameful marriage." Dude's a real charmer, huh? Anyway, what I really want you to notice is how effectively Meyerbeer marshals the huge forces at hand. 7 vocal soloists, multiple choruses, and a huge oversized orchestra. Let's listen to this concluding number from Act 2 of Meyerbeer's The Huguenots. Now, look, I don't think anyone's going to mistake this for being inspired music, but Meyerbeer's musical management style shows incredible finesse. Scores like this one were a powerful influence on later composers, particularly Verdi. We merely have to think about the first act crowd scenes in Verdi's Otello, and we can see that part of the inspiration could very well come from scenes like this in French grand opera. Now, side by side with grand opera, French opera comique developed. There were two essential differences between opera comique and grand opera. Opera comique employed spoken dialogue rather than recitative, and two, the size and subject matter of opera comique, whether presented as comedy or as drama, was less pretentious and more straightforward than in grand opera. Composers of such opera comique operas included Ferdinand Herold, Daniel Auber, and Jacques Offenbach, whose operas are still done today and are very pleasing. Lyric opera was a sort of halfway between grand opera and opera comique. Like opera comique, lyric opera often used spoken dialogue and direct appealing melody. Like grand opera, lyric opera tended towards the large scale in both numbers of performers and the grandiosity of the staging. Such operas include Charles Gounod's Faust and Romeo and Juliet, Camille Saint-Saëns' Samson and Delilah, and, of course, Georges Bizet's Carmen of 1875. Georges Bizet, 1838 to 1875. Between 1883 and 1979, Carmen was performed 521 times at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. Only Aida by Verdi and La Bohème by Puccini received more performances during that period. Transformed into ballets, musicals, and movies, Carmen is not only one of the most popular operas of all time, but it's one of the best written and composed ones as well. Friedrich Nietzsche of all people, wrote this of Carmen. Yesterday I heard, would you believe it, Bizet's masterpiece for the 20th time. Again I stayed there with tender devotion. Again I did not run away. The triumph over my impatience surprises me. How such a work makes one perfect. One becomes a masterpiece oneself. Really, every time I heard Carmen, I seemed to myself more of a philosopher, a better philosopher than I generally consider myself. So patient do I become, so happy, so Indian, so settled, to sit still for 5 hours, the first stage of true holiness. Ultimately, for me, Carmen is about love. Not the love of a higher virgin, though, but love as fatality, cynical, cruel. That love which is war in its means, and at the bottom, the deadly hatred of the sexes. I know no case where the tragic joke that constitutes the essence of love is expressed so strictly, translated with equal terror into a formula, as in Don Jose's last cry, which concludes the opera. Yes, I have killed her. My adored Carmen. Bizet himself, my friends, lived a short and unhappy life. He died nearly penniless 3 months after the premiere of Carmen. If he had lived 3 more years, he would have seen his opera triumph in Vienna, St. Petersburg, Dublin, London, and New York. Quick synopsis. Carmen is about two very different people and their mutual destruction at each other's hands. Carmen herself is the embodiment of temptation and primal destructive sexuality. As we discussed before in a previous lecture, she's a sort of Eve and the serpent and apple all rolled into one. Don Jose, when we first meet him, is a simple and decent soldier, but by the end of the opera, he is a homicidal lunatic, a love-crazed outcast. The catalyst for Don Jose's transformation, for his downfall, is Carmen, although he could not have become what he did if it was not in him from the start. Don Jose is Adam. Adam is every man. Don Jose's destruction, due to his out-of-control sexuality and machismo, makes him a universal symbol of the nature and unrestrained danger of male sexuality. Carmen, as an opera, then, is a frank and powerful look at the brutal and transformational power of unrestrained sexuality, love and desire, violence and fate. It's not a pretty story, and it shocked audiences in 1875. Quickly, let's take a listen to the pivotal scene, pivotal where Carmen is concerned, the so-called card trio of Act Two, where Carmen reads, that is, foresees her own death in a deck of cards. All right, the fatalism with which Carmen accepts the reading ennobles her. She's no longer master of her own fate, and from here to the end of the opera, she's swept forward by a chain of events which, while she initiated them, she is now no longer able to control. She is doomed, and she knows it, and it imbues her with a certain tragic beauty. All right, I set the scene. Act three. A wild place in the mountains. A number of smugglers and gypsies are lying scattered about, wrapped in their cloaks. Carmen and Don Jose, now an outlaw, have the following conversation. Don Jose, Carmen, let's make up. And Carmen says, no. Don Jose, so you don't love me anymore? And Carmen says, well, one thing's for sure, I don't love you nearly as much as I used to. I'll end up not liking you at all. I don't want to be pestered and especially not told what to do. What I want is to be free to do what I want. Don Jose says, if you talk once more about breaking up, and Carmen interrupts him, what will you do? Kill me? Duh. Wrong thing to say to the wrong person. Carmen sits brooding over this conversation. Meanwhile, nearby, her friends Frasquita and Mercedes take out a deck of cards and begin telling their fortunes. First, we hear just some preliminary music. Cut, move the cards, shuffle, and so forth. But then the two ladies sing together. And now, my beauties, tell us all the future. Tell us all that's new. Tell us who will play us false. Tell us all who will love us true. Tell. This is light and engaging music, and it indicates that the ladies are having fun. They're on a lark. Let's listen to the beginning. So up to now, our card trio is a card duet. And then Frasquita and Mercedes read the cards. What Frasquita wants is a young man courting her, and the cards tell her that she will soon fall in love. What Mercedes wants is an old and rich man who will die quickly, and the cards supposedly tell her that that's what she's going to receive as well. And then having read the cards and these lovely fortunes, we hear that same wonderful refrain, very cheerful, that we just heard. Of course, Carmen is looking on, and she says, now then, let me try my turn. And she starts turning the cards over. Now, since the first act of this opera, there's been a musical idea that's been associated with Carmen's dangerous seductiveness and ultimately her doom. And this is what it has sounded like. And we hear that music as Carmen is turning over the cards. Diamonds, spades, death. I saw it, no doubt. First me, pointing to Don Jose, then him. For both of us, death. And as Carmen continues turning over the cards, she sings of how, no matter what you want, the cards tell the truth. Whether you want youth and beauty or money, the cards cannot lie. Let's just listen to the beginning of Carmen's part in this card trio, and then I'll tell you what happens next. And while Carmen sings this paean to her own fate and acknowledges the cards can never lie, the other two women come in and sing their cheerful refrain, and once again creating in a trio something that could never happen on the spoken stage. Two completely different texts set to different music, representing two entirely different emotional worlds, heard simultaneously. In spoken theater, this would be chaotic and incomprehensible, but of course, in opera, it is the essence of what can be achieved. In the card trio, Bizet offers us two different emotional worlds, first consecutively, and then, had we enough time to listen, simultaneously. We, as listeners, understand Carmen's despair, even as the lighthearted mood of the other women continues. It's operatic drama at its most powerful. Now, sadly, this is as far as we have time to go. The folly of a survey course like this one will never be more obvious than in such a brief look at such a masterwork as Carmen. However, we should now have an intellectual and aesthetic approach to French opera that allows us to see and hear some of the differences between it and mainstream Italian opera. Historical differences, aesthetic differences, musical differences. Seek it all out, my friends. The rest is up to you. For now, we move onward to German opera. Thank you very much. Welcome to How to Listen to and Understand Opera, Lecture 23, the first of a two-lecture set entitled French Opera. We begin at the beginning. French opera at its beginnings, Jean-Baptiste Lully. French opera, that is, French language opera, came into being in 1669 with the foundation of the Académie Royale de Musique in Paris, the Royal Academy of Music. Now, this would seem, compared to the invention of Italian opera back in 1600, a fairly late date. By 1669, opera was, in Italy, a hugely important and profitable form of both aristocratic and popular entertainment. And I would tell you that throughout the 17th century, the French court and Italy enjoyed close political and cultural relations. So the French knew well about the invention and popularity of opera in Italy. The comparatively late development of French opera has much to do with the nature of the French language and, if I may generalize, the nature of the French spirit. First, the nature of the language. For many years, French composers and philosophes believed that their language was not suited to recitative, which, of course, is the foundation of Baroque opera. And two, this issue of spirit. Italian-style opera was not particularly congenial to the Gallic spirit, with its rationalistic bias and its impatience for the absurdities intrinsic to Italian opera. The French, my friends, preferred their drama straight. No ice, no water. They regarded music in the theater as an accompaniment to dance and to spectacle. As French drama and ballet were the best of their kind in the European world, it would seem that the French had no desire to water either drama or ballet down by trying to combine them into some larger form of opera. Now, despite these various biases against opera, a genuine French operatic school came into being due primarily to one extraordinary man, and that man was Jean-Baptiste Lully, who was born in 1632 and died in 1687. All right, Lully. He's Italian by birth. We will find it remarkable the degree to which foreign-born composers of French opera influenced the growth and progress of French opera, really, until the mid-19th century. Lully came to Paris at the age of 14. Though he was trained as a dancer and a violinist, he quickly developed as a first-rate conductor and then as a composer. Through equal parts talent, scheming, shrewdness, possibly even assassination, Lully climbed the French musical ladder, becoming ultimately the master of all music at the French court. And the French court at this time was not your typical 17th century gathering of bag-wigged, unbathed, over-perfumed, and powdered fat cats, although they were there in goodly number. No. Oh, no. Lully's patron was none other than King Louis XIV, the so-called Sun King, who reigned for an incredible 72 years. Louis XIV was the most powerful European monarch of his day, and he was intent that the entire world should know it. The pomp and ceremony observed at his court were carried really to absurd lengths. And the art that Louis commissioned and almost, actually, let me say that again, the art that Louis commissioned almost invariably celebrated the majesty of the state, which of course Louis proclaimed, c'est moi, is me. Incidentally, Louis's taste for huge, magnificent art and architecture was matched by his own gluttony and girth. An autopsy revealed his stomach to be between 2 and 3 times normal size. Louis liked things big. Look, Louis XIV's fame and power were such that Lully's music was heard, performed, and imitated across Europe. So what was Lully's operatic style? What did he come up with that would make opera palatable to French audiences, initially, if not hostile, then at least recalcitrant about adopting this Italian national pleasure as their own? All right, Jean-Baptiste Lully was a very shrewd biscotto. He created his musical niche by writing operas that incorporated elements from every musical and dramatic genre that had already proved to be popular in France. So, Lully's operas combined, one, literature, French classic tragedy as exemplified by the works of Corneille and Racine, drama that was dignified and restrained as opposed to that crazy Italian stuff we would witness in contemporary Italian opera seria or Italian operas. Huge and dramatic stage sets and machinery were also popular in France. And Lully made sure he had the biggest and most magnificent. Again, the bigger the better. It was all seen as a manifestation of the greatness of the king himself. And most importantly, Lully included in his operas ballet. Not a dance number or two, my friends, but almost equal amounts of dance as there was singing. Please, a quick diversion. We've got to talk about the nature of French ballet. Staged professional dance, ballet, had been a hugely popular French aristocratic entertainment since at least the 16th century. Louis XIV, tub au beurre that he may have been, fancied himself a dancer and was himself a tremendous patron of dance. Lully realized from the very get-go that without dance, and lots of it, his operas would not appeal to French aristocratic audiences. So he included dance, and this popularity, this necessity of having dance in opera continues in French opera to the 19th century. Now, this passion, and I consider it borderline mania, for ballet and their operas continues really until the very recent past. This passion and the promise of a Parisian performance convinced any number of non-French composers to add dance sequences to operas that had already been completed and successfully premiered outside of France. Look, even Verdi, who was seemingly immune from criticism and artistically gave no quarter to anyone, even Verdi added a ballet sequence to the third act of his opera Macbeth when it was performed in Paris in 1865, 18 years after its premiere in Florence. Richard Wagner, for his part, had a hell of a time trying to figure out where to insert a ballet sequence in his Tannhäuser when it was performed in Paris in 1861. He finally decided to insert this dance sequence at the very beginning of the opera, pretty much to get it out of the way as quickly as possible. And even though it's some of the best music that Wagner ever wrote, the Parisian audience rejected it. You see, it wasn't just enough to include ballet in the opera. The ballet had to occur in a specific place in the opera, later in the work, so that certain audience members wouldn't miss the dancing if they finished their dinners late and arrived past curtain time, which many typically did. Well, excusez-moi. Tannhäuser was received very poorly in Paris, and for once, and only once in our lives, we might feel just a little bit sorry for Richard Wagner. Now, back to Lully. Lully's operas then created a model, a sort of French national style based on magnificence, tragic drama, employing dance, and it's a model that would endure for 150 years. Lully and his librettist Philippe Quinault created the following operatic formula, and this is different from the formula that will be created by Metastasio and his cohorts in Italian opera in another 20 or 30 years. Here's Lully and Quinault's formula. These operas are divided into five acts. Always, there was a prologue devoted to the glorification of Louis XIV with allusions to important recent events of his reign. Two, the action, which would unroll with majestic indifference to dramatic realism, presented all kinds of improbable adventures. In the gaps between these adventures, we hear characters discoursing at length on love and honor. Three, there are rarely comic figures. Everything was stately, formal, and detached from reality. As Donald Grout observes, this was, quote, kingly opera par excellence, designed not for the general public, as in Venice, not even for an aristocracy, as in Rome and Florence, but for a single individual who was conceived to embody the perfection of national taste and whose approbation alone was sufficient to guarantee success. What Louis approved, few dared to condemn. At its best, early French opera was impressive, noble, rich, and dignified. At its worst, barren, stereotyped, pale, and thin, unquote. Again, the TV simile is irresistible. Like television, a medium capable of great power and profundity, like TV, a medium also and always, it seems, debased into a stereotypical and barren form. Two more points, and then we shall listen to some Lully. Without a doubt, Lully's greatest operatic contribution was in designing a recitative style suited to the long vowels and very light consonances of the French language. 4 points regarding Lully's recitatives. Point one, Lully claimed his model was the style of dramatic declamation employed in the tragedies heard at the Comédie Française. So he based his declamation on spoken drama. Two, his recitatives are almost entirely syllabic. That is, one syllable per pitch, one pitch per syllable. Three, the flexibility and fluidity of the French language is mirrored notationally with continuous changes of time signature. So we're going to hear in French recitatives a very serpentine and continuous and arrhythmic sensibility, which stands opposed to Italian recitative, which does not change time signature and tends to have a clearer sense of forward rhythmic drive. And four, Lully's recitative also commonly falls into melodic patterns. And this also sets it apart from Italian recitative, which is almost always what we call through composed. That is, you don't hear melodic patterns in Italian recitative. The melodies keep developing as they go. But Lully's recitatives become almost sing-song like because of the use of these melodic patterns. Finally, Lully's arias are also very different from Italian opera arias, and 4 points regarding Lully's arias. Number one, they tend to be brief and narrow in vocal range. Number two, they generally do not stand alone as musical numbers, but rather they merge with or are embedded into longer sequences of recitatives, duets, choruses, and so forth. So the aria is not the central object in a Lully French opera, and since Lully becomes the model for the next 150 years, the aria is not the central event in French opera, period. This stands completely opposite the tradition, of course, we see in Italy. Point three of Lully's arias, they do not use coloratura, all that fussy and marvelous embellishment familiar in Italian aria singing will not be present in French. And fourthly, because they do not use coloratura, French singers required less virtuosity than Italian singers. In place of virtuosity, French singers cultivated clear enunciation and better acting skills than their Italian counterparts. All right, that brings us to Armide. Armide, on a libretto by Philippe Quinault, was one of Lully's last operas produced in Paris in 1686. I set the scene. Armide is a beautiful enchantress with a hobby. She captures